Cricket is a lot of things, but cricket isn't your dad yelling out, "Nice shot, son, you can still make it." It's Donald Trump bats eight and doesn't bowl.
Cricket isn't freshly pressed, spotless whites that proudly represent your club, your family and you. It's sweat-laden cotton marinating in the fumes of the rest of your kit, only to emerge on Saturday after establishing that we're fielding, boys, whereupon you realise you've lost your club cap. You say, "I'm missing my cap, boys. Who stole my cap? Does anyone have a spare cap?"
Cricket isn't about playing with a straight bat and putting away the bad balls. It's about putting your left pad on first because you hit a 50 once when you were 12, and that's the only way you can hit runs. Just one of many absurd superstitions you've developed over the past 20 years to help you succeed in the tough, mentally challenging world of cricket, unaware that these obscure safety-seeking behaviours will eventually take over your entire life and lead your family doctor to diagnose you with obsessive-compulsive disorder. Thanks, cricket.
The Great Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a great cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the Great Cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible, at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Great Cricketer Podcast on Fox Sports. My name is Ian Higgins. I'm joined today by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. It is a monumental day for us as human beings in this society and the world. Donald Trump has literally just given his acceptance speech announcing that Hillary Clinton called him on the phone to concede defeat. But you don't care about that because you're listening to a cricket podcast the day after the biggest event in the world. So, boys, welcome. Thanks for joining me and thanks for not watching Donald Trump's speech.
Well, I mean, we have had to rebrand this the Great Cricketer Trump Cast, though, I believe, now that we're out of
legally
Fox Sports. So why don't we just get this Trump stuff out of the way early? Because there are synergies, sorry to use that sort of bastardized corporate term, but
That's okay.
Synergies between Trump and Great Cricket. We've been exploiting them for a while.
Sure.
Yeah, it's been a terrible week for Australian cricket fans who swing liberal, but a wonderful week for South African Donald Trump fans. I think if you're listening, so a cheerio to you out there. I mean, let's start with the Simpsons line. I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords. How do you guys feel?
Look, mate, it's a little bit scary. I wasn't expecting, I don't think any of you guys were, but you know, to me, it kind of reminds me of when T20 came around. And Hillary Clinton, she's test cricket. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump's T20, and I was scared when T20 came out of nowhere. You know, fireworks, female cheerleaders,
R&B.
You know, disruption, basically. But no one died, and we had plenty of laughs, so I remain hopeful.
In a lot of ways, there is some synergy with the first test defeat, because obviously the polls were suggesting that Hillary Clinton would win, and those are the polls where people vote for, not the Polish people, of course.
But this is about to clarify.
It's all about clarity in this podcast.
Clinton fans
out there. And so I think we were expecting a strong Australian performance. We were expecting a strong Hillary performance in the polls. And this week, we've been disappointed on both fronts.
Which dressing room do you think is more somber, or was more somber, the Australian dressing room or the American collective dressing room on the
Clinton,
East and West Coast?
Clinton, 100%. Have you seen the photos? There's like, it's like looking at the Hindenburg go down, like the young, white, good-looking people in the Clinton camp, like mouths agasp.
And you can just imagine the Trump dressing room. It's just dirty blokes in white. That's
right.
We did it, boys.
The biggest song of all time. Oh. Dressing rooms are being destroyed as we speak. Collective dressing rooms, that is. We wouldn't be endorsing that anywhere else. So we're obviously ready to start making comedy about this. They say comedy is sort of tragedy plus time. I mean, has there been enough time? He literally just gave his acceptance speech.
6 minutes, yeah. Let's get right into it, yeah.
I just want to say one last thing about it as well. I mean, if there's never been a better time to release bad news about anything going on in life right now, because this is wall-to-wall US presidential coverage.
Absolutely.
So I just wanted to ask you guys if there's anything you want to confess that won't be heard by anybody, and you can just say it happened publicly. Yeah. I shot JFK.
I always knew that Zapruder film was fake.
Yeah. I also stole all our club's cricket balls as well. Bevan White, if you're listening. Bev, g'day Bev.
Bevan White.
Is this not just the greatest blowout of all time? I mean, if this was a person on the circuit, they'd been a bad circuiter, you know, on the drink for a long time, bad social reputation, then decided to be good, you know, to be disciplined in body and mind, to be nice to people, save some money a little bit. And then decide, no, that's it. I'm just going to have a massive blowout and just everything's worse than it already was. That's what yeah. I feel like America is right now. It's just a massive blowout.
America is...
So, re-correction.
America's the fourth grade captain who had a stable marriage for 7 years, 8 years, actually. And and it all went wrong. And he has had a huge, huge blowout. And what has he done? He's woken up the next day and Donald Trump's the president of the United States. Mm.
There was some cricket that took place. A match ended a couple of days ago.
It feels like a lifetime ago, Piers.
But let's review Australia South Africa in the first test. We didn't expect this result either because we're completely ignorant and I think we're much better than we are. Everything was bad for Australia. They lost by 177 runs. We've lost our luster at home. Everything just seemed bad. You know, our batters were bad. Our bowlers were bad. We didn't catch anything. Nah. Everything is Lions' fault. Everything's a selector's fault. Yeah. We've got no confidence at home at all, which was our kind of domain. What were your main takeaways?
Look, I mean, for me, losing on home soil is the biggest takeaway. We're so dominant at home. And, you know, it's for me, it's kind of like the time when you realise your casual drinking is a problem. you know, it started off as a glass after work, after, you know, just one glass, and then two glasses, then it's a bottle. Suddenly you're making a drunken speech at your cousin's wedding and you're regretting the hell out of it. And that's kind of what I think happened to us at the Wacker.
Same thing.
It's exactly the same thing. It was a drunk wedding speech that raised eyebrows and Australian cricket needs an intervention.
Yeah. I mean, and what would an intervention look like? I mean, I've always been a big sort of believer in reports.
Mm. Where would you have the intervention?
That's right.
Are we getting all the cricketers together and we're, you know, in the dressing room and having a chat about it? Where do we stage this?
I think we need a club lock-in. Yeah, for sure.
The only way to get us through this is a club lock-in. Yeah,
that's the only way to get through anything.
That's the big takeaway. It was just really surprising, the capitulation. Like, wasn't it all great? We refreshed our Facebook news feeds and we've seen that Mitchell Marsh has taken a great grab in the gully in the first over of the test match or whatever it was. Yep. And we're thinking, you beauty, this will be over in 2.5 days. We're going to win. We are the best thing ever. Australia is God. Mm. That's what everyone was saying.
Everyone.
And then as it transpired, you know, it went even better. We rolled them for 230. David Warner creaming them. He's on 97. He's on 71, you know, not out overnight. Mm. Partnership of 130-odd. And we're thinking this is going to be a huge lead. We'll probably win this match by an innings. And then we lost 10 for none. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we have a small deficit.
Two-run lead.
Two-run lead. You're right, Pez. Two-run lead. And then from there, it was just the South Africa show, wasn't it? And I think we all just turned off our televisions and then started supporting Kyrgios.
That's exactly what happened.
You speak for all of us, as always.
You're on the Grey Cricketer podcast, where we speak for everybody.
We speak to everybody.
Very straight sentences. Yeah. So are we taking a bit away from South Africa there as well? Were they excellent or were we just ordinary? Does it even matter?
Weren't we bad, though? Because we're talking about the attack last week and we were prefacing that it was going to be Steyn and Morkel. Well, I certainly was anyway. Wrong on both counts. Morkel not even picked. And that was like a big controversy because he was declared fit the day before. Then all of a sudden, not even the starting 11. Mm. And then Steyn bowls for about 15 minutes and then just out. He's out. Yeah, it's him done. So we're thinking, oh, we'll cruise this. And then we got absolutely pumped. Us in the room, we did. Yeah. We did, because I'm part of that team. That's bad. It's bad, Pez. Well, you know, it's really bad.
We all assumed, and you know, we said as much last week, that it was going to be a procession of runs and wickets for Australia in the first test. And
right.
This would go
3-0.
Throughout the summer.
3-0.
3-0, and then 3-0 versus the Pakistanis, and then, you know, just 6-0.
Never lose again. Win every match.
Yeah, especially at home. But no, we've been absolutely troubled and shocked by this, as Hillary Clinton has today. There's so many synergies, as you say, Pez. It's astounding. Look, I mean, you asked where do we go from here. We've got to pick up our slacks and we've got to get out there and we've got to make a show of it.
And that's why I'm prepared to declare that when most people listen to this podcast, Australia will probably be none for 400 with two double centuries to the openers because we'll win again and we'll win forever.
We'll win forever. It is concerning, though, with the manner that we lost in South Africa pre this series. A lot of people have forgotten about that because it's a lifetime ago now, but we did lose every single one of those 1 days. We got pumped in Sri Lanka. It just feels like a long time since we've won some cricket matches, and we need to win some cricket matches.
We need to end matches with superior amount of runs than other sides and them dismissed.
Yeah, that's the intervention.
On South Africa, though, just for a second, a couple of awesome displays from them. Bavuma's run out, something decidedly superior in its athleticism. It had a sort of an NBA quality to it, that run out. I mean, there's been no shortage of superlatives. It really is the best run out I've ever seen. Mm. It's the sort of run out that you see in the shorter version of the game now as part of the massive highlight reels to encourage people to think that the shorter version actually has the most explosive things happening. But the timing of that run out on the day of the test match that it happened made it even more special. Seriously, yeah. Best run out I've seen.
Cricket doesn't have many like visceral moments where you just, you shout at the screen.
Yeah.
You know? Sorry, I thought you had to launch into another cricket is.
But, you know, just to see that come out of nowhere, as you say, was absolutely amazing.
It was the facial dunk in the NBA. It was get out of your seat. That is the best thing I've ever seen.
It was blokes holding each other back on the bench with, you know, waving the towels on the sides. Paddy Mills.
And also, Kagiso Rabada, did you watch any of his bowling? Did you watch any of Rabada's bowling?
Not at all.
I don't know why I looked at you and asked that question. It was just sensational, yeah, seriously. I've started an appreciation society, which you're welcome to join. But it was like sort of Simon Jones 2005-esque, Flintoff 05, the mastery of the reverse swinging ball. Also something we now can't do, that's Nathan Lyon's fault, apparently.
Yeah.
It was something to behold. He's 21. He's awesome, and I want to appreciate him throughout the summer.
So let's talk about one of the big wickets that Rabada took during the test match, and that was the one of Mitchell Marsh, which has somehow caused a lot of controversy. Yep. If I can give you guys my take on it, that's hitting all three stumps. And I'll tell you why I think that, because the technology said it did. And I believe the technology. I believe in science.
You believe in science over gut feel.
Global warming is real.
Yeah, scientists, technology, peer-reviewed academic papers. Yeah. You know, why listen to or read any of those things when you can go with gut feel?
Well, that's right. And on this momentous evening where Donald Trump has sort of announced or sort of accepted the presidency of the US, I mean, it is fair to say that the DRS is the climate change of cricket.
And Trump said that it was a myth created by the Chinese government.
Oh, it's a Chinese hoax. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
I would imagine that one of Trump's first edicts would be to rid cricket of DRS. and to go with
the first 100 days, I think he announced it.
That was in the first 100 days, was it? Okay, that's right, good. Yeah. And that's also why the Channel 9 commentary team will prosper throughout the summer, because they go with their gut.
Yeah.
You know, they saw what the ball was doing. It was going down.
Yeah, and they play test cricket. Therefore, they know all. They know facts. Yeah. They're
the bloke operating the DRS didn't play test cricket. And you have to have played test cricket to make any informed comments on cricket.
I think you could actually, sometimes you can hear the commentators in the background when you're watching the DRS. They turn the mics down, but the noise is so loud. And I think I did hear Ian Healy say, how many tests has this bloke played?
I think the nature of the LBW, because I know a lot of our listeners will disagree with what I've just said, and I'll take the brunt of it. But like the way it hit his pad, he kind of like, when it hit him, he did flick his leg down towards leg. So I thought it gave that optical illusion of that. Well, that's clearly
classic
missing.
Reaction to being hit on the leg as well.
But it hit him on middle stump and it was going to hit leg stump, and the angle of Rabada bowling suggests that's a pretty accurate trajectory.
So do you think that the, you know, Healy and Mark Taylor and Michael Clark and everyone that you've just mentioned were swayed by the fact that he moved his leg upon impact, just, you know, thrust down the leg side, and that confused them?
I think it did confuse them. Also the fact that Mitchell Marsh then managed to, like, it hit his pad flush and then he managed to punch it down the ground for four. It was quite an unusual set of circumstances, But in my opinion, and I'm basing that on science and peer reviews, it's incorrectly, obviously, but that's just out. Yeah. He was out, and science says that he was out.
Oh, mate, it didn't, you know, moon happening didn't happen either. You know, it was definitely filmed in the desert in Arizona.
That's very good. I mean, we're talking about the Channel 9 commentary team. Yep. It's always a talking point at the start of every summer. It's a revamped commentary team, not completely new, but revamped. Out with Lee and Hussey and in with KP and Clark. Dave, who didn't watch a ball of the test, what'd you make of the commentary team? Sorry.
The revamped commentary team. Isn't that just a branding buzzword as well that means ultimately nothing? Yeah. Look, I did catch some of the test. Thank you, Pezza. KP and Clark, I really enjoyed their dynamic. They just seem like best buds, don't they? Just an absolute bromance blossoming offset between those two.
Isn't it great to listen to best buds chatting?
Yeah, yeah.
You're listening to the Grey Cricketer podcast. <That's right. laughs>
But, you know, KP seems to be reveling in his role as media pundit. And I think I saw on Twitter someone made a rather humorous observation that he wouldn't look out of place in a David Attenborough-esque documentary. You know, whispering tones, you know, when rhinos are copulating.
I just thought you meant he was an animal. Like, literally, he was just going to be filmed with
iguanas. Well, he's gazelle-like when he... I think one of the great things for me in the limited amount of that match that I watched was seeing the new ads that are out this summer. There's always new ads
fresh
every
ads.
Summer. What were your favourite guys? Well, there's a couple to go through. I mean, maybe we can start with Dave Warner's ad.
Yeah.
Brilliant ad.
Yeah. The way he said the company name over and over again is very important, obviously, in marketing. Edo's, you've got some experience there in that dynamic, and it is important to say OLED over and over and over again.
Oh, absolutely, 10 out of 10.
I think for me, the best part was the way he's sitting in the commercial. Like, he's kind of got his legs crossed in a very elegant way, and you just know that Dave Warner isn't a leg crosser. He's definitely a guy who's just in the sheds, legs spread as wide as humanly possible, throwing a ball between his hands. You know, he's that kind of guy. He just didn't seem right and didn't seem natural for me on the couch.
Sure.
I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised to learn a little bit about the importance of the blacks on a TV screen as well and how that actually contrasts the colour. I'd never even thought about the absence of colour in the actual recognition of colour.
And I don't know. Study colour theory.
Well, just on that, I think now's an appropriate time to hear a word from our sponsors.
I'm generally away during the winter, so I have the entire summer to spend at home watching cartoons with the kids. And I really love my OLED TV. Like, really, really love it. One of the things I look forward to most when I come home is actually to be able to sit down on the couch in front of my OLED TV and just say the word OLED repeatedly. I really like saying the word OLED. I'd never heard it before, this paid commercial, but I enjoy the way it rolls off my tongue, like some kind of exotic Spanish word. OLED, OLED, OLED. It drives my wife nuts, but the kids love it. And LG OLED TV. OLED. You'll hear it 1,000 times this summer. So go on, try saying it 1,000 times too.
But it wasn't the only ad, he goes, and Dave, that has been absolutely saturating our minds as the cricket started. The Commonwealth Bank's out with an ad as well.
Yep.
I'm not even sure if we're allowed to mention that business. But nevertheless, Steve Smith, Josh Hazlewood and Usman Khawaja, clearly doing business for the Commonwealth Bank, appealing appallingly in a hotel. And there's something very unsettling about the way they appeal. I know it wasn't as prolific an ad as the OLED OLED TV ad, but that's one to watch out for as well. If you really want to rile yourself up, watch the Commonwealth.
It feels a lot like when you drive past the cricket, or when you feel playing and there's a car that drives past the cricket oval around about 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and the car yells out, "How's that?" or other things like that. I've heard cricket sucks.
Yeah.
The one that's gone past. Well, these guys are on their way to the beach. I mean, a great time. Maybe a few beers in the back seat. I don't know. But I'm out there. You know, it's 3 for 276.
Yeah.
It's the 43rd over. I'm hot. I'm tired. I'm emotional. And I want to see these guys go to the beach and have a great
time.
You
want to be in that car, don't you?
I want to be in the car.
You hate the sound of it, but you just would love to be there with those lads going to the beach that you desperately miss.
I've always been really curious. I mean, whenever I see that happen, if I've been on the field, I quickly try and scan as to how many people are in the car. And I'm always, I mean, sometimes there's one, sometimes there's four. And I'm always curious. Yeah, well, I want to get
Six
that.
Beers.
I'm always curious about the way that question or the decision to yell it out comes about beforehand.
Like, yeah. Oh, what are we going with, boys?
Check this out. No, how's that? How's that? That's a good one.
How's that?
Or just someone there on their own just driving past and goes, "Oh, this will be a bit of fun."
Yeah.
Cricket sucks is the best one. It really cuts to the core.
Yeah.
It does suck.
Yeah.
It is bad. Back to the ads, though, just briefly. I mean, I think the secret to advertising cricket or using cricketers in your advertising is to put them in a backyard setting. And I think every great successful ad that I've seen involving cricket is just the current Australian team in a backyard, you know, maybe wearing cargo shorts, you know, out of their usual whites, having a great time. And isn't that what I'm looking for in an ad?
Yeah, I don't like it when they're wearing their work clothes in a non-work environment.
Yeah.
So like when they're wearing just their whites at the shops or, you know, in the backyard, it doesn't feel natural.
That's where I disagree with you, Higos. I absolutely love the idea of Australian cricketers walking around in civil society in whites or turning up to family Christmases in their tracksuit.
In a baggy
green. Australian tracksuit.
At all times.
Yeah. At all times, anything they do, they never leave it.
Should we crack on with the second test? It's happening. It's a thing.
What's there to say? I mean, the selectors have said that they would retain the side. So obviously following that, Sean Marsh, Adam Voges and Peter Siddle look like they're out. And in comes Joe Manny, Callum Ferguson and Joe Burns. I like it because I just want to see Ferguson and just because I unashamedly just want to see someone new.
Something different.
I need something trivial. It speaks to my superficiality.
Yeah. Can we talk about Sean Marsh falling over and breaking his finger? I mean, he's made of glass, isn't he? Like, what's like? He's got salad fingers. Like, just falling over and he's just broken. He's just broken. How has this happened? Like, he's a professional athlete. That's his job.
Sorry, I'm just coming to terms with the concept of salad fingers. How does salad become the thing that describes something brittle?
Isn't salad your hair cut? Like, yeah. Isn't that another great cricket term?
Not necessarily.
Great salad, mate.
I mean, it's just soft, isn't it? Like, it's just like if you had lettuce for fingers, obviously. Yeah. It would just be just fold. I don't know why.
I'm just starting to think about like avocado on someone's fingers and cherry tomatoes and lettuce and stuff. Like, oh, he's got salad hands.
Bit of feta. You go for a Greek salad there. What do you think about the fact that even though, you know, these unfortunate injuries have occurred, that the Cricket Australia and the selectors specifically said that they would take the same team into the second test.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? I mean, that I'm from the school of thought that you've got to be putting pressure on people at all times. You know, in the corporate world, for example, you know, a good sales director will put pressure on his sales force by maybe there'll be a CRM that people can log into and see each other's pipelines. Maybe an admin staff member will send an email around, you know, highlighting the best deals of the week. And that'll put pressure on all the other people in the team. So it's all about, for me, creating tension and anxiety and breeding good performances. So why isn't Cricket Australia, I mean, I know Cricket Australia likes to think of itself as a corporation. Why aren't they taking that corporate approach?
Well, let's put them in touch with you if you're listening. Cricket Australia has got to develop some pipelines and create anxiety. Very, very simple. It does reveal mental fragility, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. That they feel like they need to protect the players in the side at the moment.
But if the cricketers feel comfortable, you know, it's like cruising by on your base salary to keep the sales analogy going. You know, we want these cricketers chasing commissions. Runs and wickets are the commissions of the cricket world.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about like...
This is a Trump world. That's what he's done his whole time.
Exactly.
Let's talk about, I mean, someone who's under a lot of pressure is Mitchell Marsh, right? And he is probably the biggest rig in the team. So therefore, probably one of the first names on the team sheet. Mm. Now, he's struggled a little bit in his test career. I think he averages around about 30 with the bat and not great with the ball.
Lower than that, I think.
It's okay with the ball, but it's not great just yet. But he's obviously showing a lot of promise. He's a young guy and also rig. But pressure on him, and then, you know, Neville has scored 230 in a Shield game at Hobart.
Right.
So can he bat six? Should he be batting six? He averages 43 in Shield cricket.
He certainly should be.
Can I speak really plainly about it? I think Peter Neville is a better batsman than Mitchell Marsh, so therefore he should be higher in the order. I also think that Australia should have six batsmen in the side because they're not scoring very many runs.
Nah.
I don't mean to oversimplify. Sorry, did you say? I don't mean to skew to oversimplification about it, but I feel like an all-rounder in the side at the moment is kind of like robbing Peter to pay Paul a little bit. You know, there's a little bit of bowling, a little bit of batting,
exactly,
and it's not really working. Oh, we need runs. We don't score runs. Let's have batsmen who do that as a profession.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, there's something alluring about having an all-rounder. Hedging. It's all about hedging your bets.
Of course.
And, you know, if we take away an all-rounder and we're just playing, it's a bit conservative, isn't it? And Australian cricket doesn't like conservatism. Mm. We're all about aggression and alphadom.
It has been referred to as the best sports writing tribute to a particular sport since Fever Pitch.
Does it do anything to enhance literature? Would be another question.
Another. I wouldn't even call it literature, really.
Well, lads, just another distinct pleasure to welcome somebody to the show who is, we're just not worthy or deserving of having people of this calibre on the show.
Yeah.
We've got with us Brad Hogg. Made his test debut in 1996, seven tests, 123 one-day internationals, 156 wickets for his country in one-day international cricket. Played 2020 cricket for Australia. Still playing, possibly, he can tell us. He can give us the scoop on that. Mm. Debuting at 43, I believe. He can correct that if I'm wrong. And he's just released a book. Brad, welcome to the show. How are you, mate?
Yeah, very good, very good. I'm 45 at the moment. I think you just said I was 43. And...
The other day I was on a show and someone said I played 156 games. I'm glad you said that, 156 wickets, because that's a little bit more impressive, having more wickets than games played.
Well, we do our research on the show, Brad. That's one thing you can be sure of.
Yeah, I didn't realise my stats until you just said it. And hearing the other guy the other day saying that I had played 150-odd games, I could not remember playing 150 one day in the Nationals. But
that's a
anyway,
flat lie.
I'm glad you got it right.
You know exactly how many games you played, how many runs you've scored, and wickets. So in all forms of the game.
I've got no idea. Absolutely no idea. So, yeah.
All right, Brad. Well, we like to ask this of every cricketing guest because this is the Grade Cricketer podcast after all. But can you just kind of tell us a bit about where it all started for you at the grade level?
I started in the bush, played for a team called Tarwonga, got picked for the Williams Association, came up to Perth and Fremantle Cricket Club asked me to go down there as an opening bowler who could bat a bit. So I started as an opening bowler. Turned into a batsman, played A grade as a batsman, then Shield cricket as a batsman, and then started bowling Chinaman the first year of Shield cricket. So
this is an incredible story.
It's an incredible story, Brad.
Sorry to interrupt you as you're explaining to us your career, but I need to talk. Let me just get my rhythms right in conversation. But Brad, I just read this recently, so. You were actually picked to play for WA in the mid-90s as a batsman, completely as a batsman. And then one day you were warming up some of the WA batsmen with some left-arm Chinamen to prepare them for David Friedman, for Freddie Friedman's bowling against New South Wales. And they just came out really well. And next thing you know, you're playing for Australia doing that exact thing.
Yeah, well, I was disappointed that the team manager, Tony Mann, came over and asked me to bowl those Chinamans because my medium paces, there was a little ridge there halfway down the track, and I was really troubling the batsman. And I knocked a couple of players on the head, and I was really troubling them, and I was a little bit frustrated because I thought, right, I could be here as an all-rounder just batting with a little bit of fast medium. Or should I say slow medium? But yeah, it was great that Tony Mann turned me around and told me to bowl those left-arm Chinamans. And if he didn't do that, I probably would have only played three or four Shield games. I wasn't that flashy at that level with the bat.
Brad, what I'm picking up from this is that you started bowling spin in your early 20s and you've made a very successful international career from this and a wonderful life out of this. So basically what it sounds like to me, you have to be amazingly talented to play international cricket, is that right? And I've got no hope at all. Hard work aside, it's just all natural talent.
No, there's a lot of hard work, but you could call it stupid because I was trying to do other things that I wasn't capable of, and then all of a sudden the thing that I was good at, someone else had to tell me that I was actually good at it. So, it's just amazing how it goes. And the thing is, you come across situations where, right, I'm at this stage of my life and you've got to make a decision. Do I go down that path or the other path? And I just saw there was likes of Simon Cadditch, Mike Hussey around that time and myself. And the three of us were after all bowl leg spin. So Simon with his left arm Chinamans and Michael Hussey with his right arm leg spin. They were trying to get one of us to be that spinning all-rounder. Mm. And I took to spinning a little bit more serious than my batting, and the other two took their batting a lot more serious than their bowling. So it was great that I was able to go down that line and make a career out of it, because those other two players would have kept me out of the state team as a batsman.
That is unbelievable.
I think you all made the right decision.
Well, Mike Hussey's rather smart. Simon's rather smart. And I was a stupid one who decided to go and do the harder art bowling.
Brad, if we can take you back earlier in your life, sort of even before grade cricket and country cricket days, you speak about in the book you've got a great relationship with your mother, and I believe that she had like a backyard pitch prepared for you, and she actually gave you a lot of throwdowns in your youth. Is that right?
She did. She was a very tough mother. She was a school teacher, and if I didn't do my homework, she wouldn't throw me the ball. So I became a very excellent student, or could I say I was able to mock my papers so that it looked as though I did a bit of work. And the teachers knew that I was more chance of being a sportsman than being well educated, so they were giving me the A's just to keep Mum happy, to keep her feeding the ball machine for me.
Oh, so it was an actual ball machine that your mum was feeding, not just generic throwdowns with the arm.
Well, she was throwing it down, and then she got sick of throwing balls, and she got sick of that, so she invested in a ball machine, because, thank God for that.
Because that is every young boy's dream, is to have a ball machine at home. So you were living the dream at a very early age.
Yeah, I think I would have been about 12 when she got that. So
How happy were you? Was that the greatest present you've ever received in your life?
Because Christmas is around the corner, and you know I'm still looking for one.
Yeah.
Dad. Yeah. I don't know whether it was... I don't think it was the best present for me. I think it was the best present for Mum.
That's a very, very good angle to take, actually. Brad. Want to save your shoulder, Mum? Get the ball machine.
Yeah, the Kingsgrove Sports Centre,
My presents for Mum were an alarm clock, so I could get her up in the morning before school to come out and feed the ball machine. So,
it's like Homer Simpson.
I was a pretty selfish kid. I'd always buy presents for Mum and Dad that would help me. So, but you got to be like that, don't you? If you want to get anywhere.
Oh, absolutely.
That's great, Brad. I mean, I guess what comes through when you're talking about that is that you actually have a respect for other people, unlike a lot of your colleagues who've recently started, when selling their own book, just essentially telling titillating, gossipy tales about their friends. We just want to take a moment on the show to praise you for not going down that path. You know, when you've come to, I guess, author and promote your book, you've sort of bravely and admirably focused on yourself, and I think that is something to you know, for us to call out and say well done. How did you find writing the book? And you know, if you did want to say anything to the listeners out there about you know, what they can find in it, you know, the floor's yours.
Yeah, well, look, basically, when I my grade teammates, so it's the Grade Cricketer Show, but it was my grade teammates who were trying to push me to write the book. A guy called Craig Silvey, who wrote Jasper Jones, came around with his brother Brett Silvey, who plays grade cricket with me. He captained the under-15 Australian teams, Australian team many moons ago. Those two came around and just talked to me about doing a book. And I just thought, well, what do I write about? You know, there's no point writing about things what people see on TV or people see you down the street. So I thought, right, I'm going to go into the dark days and really go behind the scenes and how it is behind the scenes. And it's not just about it's meant to be a mixture of humour, but also a lot of honesty as well. And I just wanted everyone to know who I truly am, because I do go out and speak to kids about resilience, and to be quite frank, I've got to be honest with you, with them. And when they ask me questions, I've got to be very authentic and really say the truth. If you're going to go down that path and try and be an influence to kids or give them a good path to say that, you know, you can do it. If I can do it, you've got to be honest with them. You can't hide anything. So I've basically just gone out there and just basically said all my vulnerabilities, let them out there. And the good thing about it was I had my grade mates around, or some of my close grade mates from the past that were seeing me as a junior. And when we were sitting here with Greg Rowden, who actually wrote the book, I just said to them, look, be honest. If I was the worst bloke that you ever met, I want Greg to know about it, because you know, that's my growth as a person, my growth as a cricketer, and there's no point in hiding the fact. You can go out there and say, yeah, I was a good bloke, did this and did that, but at the end of the day, I had my flaws.
It's really fascinating, Brad, because as Sam was saying, I mean, there are so many cricket books out at the moment, and I think what yours in particular has to offer, which perhaps others don't, is this really sort of like a tender vulnerability almost in your story. I know there's a chapter in the book called The Collapse, and it sort of talks about you know, a first marriage and having a second child and then giving up cricket and then falling into periods of sort of drinking and sort of the darkness of depression and stuff. I mean, it's really brave, if I can speak candidly, about speaking in these sort of things, because it's quite contrasting to other bibliographies or cricketers telling their stories. And I just want to know if that was something that you sort of had to toss and turn over about, you know, being open about these sort of things, because to a lot of young people out there, this is going to be something that's going to help them a lot.
Yeah, look, to be honest with you, I didn't even think twice about it. I just wanted everything out there, and I just said everything to Greg Rowden, and he put everything in there. I didn't really think about it till the story came out a couple of weeks ago in the newspaper story, mm-hmm. with mental health. How much of a change that sort of turned the book in a sense that I thought, all right, this is really an opportunity to help other people with that story. So yeah. It's an actual surprise how that actually came out and how that eventuated. And look, at the end of the day, I'm actually glad that it has come out, because the idea of the book was to give a little bit of humour, or to give a lot of humour, but also to help a few people out there that sort of want to strive to make something of their life or become a sportsman, and just see the troubles that you have to go through to get to the top.
That's excellent, Brad. And I just, on behalf of us as well, I think you're a little bit of a trailblazer when it comes to Australian cricket in terms of actually just being honest in the way you present yourself, because we certainly know plenty of cricketers who don't do that. So congratulations to you.
I will jump in here. When I did have my grade mates around here, right, there was about 15 of them around here, and one of the guys, Todd Lavender, just stopped everyone and said, "Look, Greg, I don't know why you're wasting your time here. It's pretty simple, this book. Let's just get a cover page, and then the next page, Hoggy doesn't mean to be a DH, and then the next page, he just is, and then put the back cover on it." So that summed it up pretty well.
I'm selling yourself short there a bit, mate. I'm sure this book has plenty of DH Lawrence in it.
That's very good. It must be quite vulnerable to sit down with your best mates while they just tell stories about who you really are.
Especially Todd Lavender. I know what he's like.
Oh, look, at the end of the day, I think it's good. It's good for growth. And I like it when people are honest with you rather than peeing in your pocket. If people are just going to dodge around you and not tell you the truth, they're not worth being friends. So
I'd like to know what it was like for you sort of in the era of Warne and McGill. I mean, that must have been a pretty tough time to think at any stage you're going to play international cricket behind, Shane Warne, and then Stuart McGill comes along and does wonderful things. I mean, what was that like for you to be behind both of those guys?
Look, I wouldn't change it. I really enjoyed it, actually, because it made you work harder and it made you strive for that goal. When you got that opportunity, you took it with both hands. And at the end of the day, I only played 7 test matches, but I think the best thing that happened throughout my career was after the 2003 World Cup, coming back to Australia, and Warnie came back from his little misdemeanour, and he wanted to play one day international cricket, and I was boosting his tyres in the media. Yeah, he's the best bowler going around, or the spin bowler going around. And Trevor Holmes, the selector at that stage, rang me up and said, "Look, mate, I'm going to tell you, this spot is yours. Don't boost Warnie's tyres. The only way he's going to get back in there if you stuff up." And when he said that to me, that's when I knew that I'd actually made it for the heights of playing for Australian cricket. I had that one day spot to myself.
Yeah. So even though you were a contemporary of Warne, Warne was just seen by all and sundry as just this kind of once in a lifetime spinner, and you kind of felt, I'm certainly second option to this guy. He's just way ahead of the pack.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. But he had an awe about him as well. He was a great bowler, but he had a presence about him as well. So it's not just about skill. Let's not take away the awe that he has, the presence that he has out in the field. And once you get a reputation like that, opposition batsmen start to panic. And the good thing with Warnie too, he had Glenn McGrath at the other end, and Gillespie and Brett Lee and the likes of Cashwich and Bickle, who all kept the pressure on. And I know myself, when I was playing one day cricket and I had those bowlers around me, it just makes your job easier as a spinner, because you know that the batsmen are thinking, right, I've got to go after the spinner, but I'm not really confident of going after the leg spinners, because we've got a little bit more variation in the off spinner. So that they knew that it was a huge risk to go after us, in a sense, but they knew that they had to take a risk because they couldn't get the other bowlers away because they're just too good.
It's been quite an amazing ride for you in the last sort of 5 years or so, Brad. You spent 5 years over at the Perth Scorchers there in the Big Bash League, which has in a lot of ways revolutionised cricket in Australia. But I'm reading that you've now signed for the Melbourne Renegades, which I'd imagine would be a huge thing for you. Having to leave Perth after being your name chanted at the Wacker over the Christmas period for the last 5 years. I mean, it must have been a big decision.
Well, in the final hours of making that decision, it wasn't that big in the end. There's things in life that happen. There's a little bit of politics, which I'm not going to go into, which is behind the scenes.
Sure.
And
Go into
that
it.
Happens. Sorry, you want to go into it?
No, just go into it. It's all right.
Yeah, right. No, but this is the thing. There's no point in going into it. It's just behind the scenes, and when your time's up, your time's up, and you've just got to move on. And there's other opportunities out there, and you've got to take it with both hands. So. Once I knew that I was making the decision, it was fine. And what's happened with the Perth Scorchers has had to come to an end at some stage, and it came a little bit earlier than I wanted. But at the end of the day, it's another opportunity for me. It's a different environment, something that I can't wait to get involved in, get my teeth into it. And it's, you know, to go to a Melbourne team, especially with the two AFL states of WA and Victoria, yeah. we really got a lot of respect for each other, but we just want to beat the hell out of each other. So it's going to be a bit of a surprise being on the other side of the fence, and I'm really looking forward to it.
That's awesome, Brad. We're going to jump into the second section of the interview called Throwdowns.
I thought this was the third section.
Yeah, that's right. So did I, actually.
Did we miss the first or second?
Just going to take an intermission. Are we back in 20?
No. So this is where we just ask a question, and what is it? He goes, last time I usurped you when you told us what the rules were, so I won't do it this time. What's the rule?
I think Brad gets it. Let's say one sentence answers.
One sentence answers. That's a bit too much for me.
So we're gonna pepper you with some short stuff, just like your mum did with the ball machine.
Yep,
and,
right. Here we go.
Hopefully you're prepared for it. So, Brad, people often describe you as a 12-year-old in a 45-year-old's body. Do you see this as a compliment or the sledge that it is?
I see that as a bit of a sledge because I got told that I was a 15-year-old in a 45-year-old body. So it's taken 3 years off me, which is good. But it's great. I feel youthful.
Brad, I mentioned this earlier, but why didn't you copiously sledge all of your teammates, past and present, in your book? Is there something wrong with you?
Yes, there is plenty wrong with me. I've got too much to come back at me on.
As the oldest guy in the team, when there is a T20 super over, are you annoyed that you have to record Antiques Roadshow?
What was that?
No, that's enough.
He heard it. Look, Brad, you're a 45-year-old man playing alongside 20-year-olds. Is this the reason you work so hard on your rig?
Definitely. My wife.
Brad, just as a
follow-up. Younger bodies.
No questions, Your Honour.
Just as a follow-up to the rig question, Brad, you have the best rig, having scored 14.1 on the beep tester previously with the Australian side. Does this mean you believe in cardio fitness during cricket pre-season?
Definitely.
Look, Brad, you used to be a postman, and thank you for your service. What are your thoughts on the future of the postal system in an increasingly digital world?
I think it's gone. At least you'll get your mail now.
Brad, in that test match against Zimbabwe at the SCG, you took 3 wickets, but you were outstripped of the awards that day by Simon Kadich, by left-arm Chinaman also, who took 6 wickets. How hard was it to look him in the eye and congratulate him?
I was really pissed off. I was a Michael Jackson of the Melbourne Cricket Club. I didn't want to talk to Gerard Healy.
It's the greatest non-sequitur of
the game. I'm only joking. I thought it was great. Simon got the wickets.
So, Brad, your book is titled The Wrong'un, which is obviously a charming cricket reference to your own character. I just wanted to know, if you're a wrong'un, who is a flipper? And if that doesn't help, who's a half-tracker? Kadich?
Oh, I've got to keep it clean. Come on. Half-tracker.
Who's a beamer?
Oh, my wife's a beamer, don't worry about that.
I will not.
Look, we've just seen, Brad, that, Donald Trump has taken the Oval Office. Do you think that Australia should pivot to Asia now that he's in charge of the free world?
As a Chinaman.
No, I'm just thinking of getting a reality show myself and becoming the next Prime Minister of Australia.
I'm sure you do it. Outstanding job at that, Brad. Look, mate, it's been a pleasure to have you on the third episode of the Grey Cricketer podcast. Really appreciate your time. Brad Hogg's book, The Wrong'un, is in stores, and it sounds like it's going to be a good read. Thank you very much for your time, mate. Really appreciate it.
No, thanks very much, mate. I'm just going down to my grey team now and going to bat them into a winning position and then bowl them out of it, as they talk.
Are you upset that no one comes to watch you play cricket? Are you tired of no one appreciating you for the talented third grader you are? The Cricket Family is the first program dedicated to helping people like you feel relevant again. We have a database of over 1,000 out-of-work actors who can come to your games and masquerade as your friend, girlfriend, wife, parents, or grandparents, helping you create the perception that the people close to you actually care about what you do.
Ah, great shot, Jason.
No, I'm proud of you, son.
The Cricket Family, helping cricketers feel relevant once again.
I just want to start with a little bit of apology. About two or three occasions, Brad was talking, and I decided to talk as well. My conversation rhythms are well off, so apologies if that's...
Well, it's our show, Pez. So.
It's a great cricketer podcast, and Brad Hogg's just on it.
Thanks for your support. I appreciate that support. That's wonderful support. Let's move into your questions, though. The people who've followed the Great Cricketer from day dot, or some who've just joined recently on Facebook, with distinctly poorer grammar.
If you want to ask us any questions during the week, you can hashtag AskTGC or just add us. Get us on the Twitter machine or, you know, I suppose Facebook if you need to.
But, we're getting a bit worried about over-promoting it, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
We're definitely selling out like the flogs we are.
Yep.
The first question coming through on AskTGC, Dave, and he goes, it's from Rooster746. His name is Rooster746. He says, what's the minimum requirement for an afternoon tea to be considered, and I say this with air quotes, a good spread?
Look, for me, guys, I think it's all about the mix. So you obviously want some fresh fruit there, just tokenistically.
Yeah.
But, you obviously. Know, Tim Tams are... You know, little small triangular shaped sandwiches, homemade, are obviously preferable. Maybe with some iceberg lettuce. That's always quite refreshing. What about you, Pigos? What's your thought?
I'd like as much colour on the table as possible. So I think the first key element is a colourful tablecloth.
Right.
And that can't be forgotten.
That's good.
But I mean, variety is your key. So as you say, you want fruit. So you've got like your watermelon, your reds, you've got some grapes, a bit of green in there. And then you've got obviously the array of biscuits and chocolates. It is inevitable. Now, without like things like sandwiches, like your white bread, sort of whole grain, multi-grain, a few more affluent suburbs, that can add a bit of texture and colour as well. Different textures on your tongue is what you need. I've had some really bad teas, haven't we all? Mm. But yeah, as much colour on that table as possible.
Yep.
I love that we answer that question with, like, it was more somber than anything else we've spoken about on this show so far.
The tea with
it really, I mean, what you guys are saying is really reflecting an increasing kind of, well, it's not elitism, but like a gourmet culture pervading Australia.
And there is a snobbery.
We missed the opportunity to ask Brad Hogg about what teas were like in the 1960s.
But I was going to say, I mean, in the same way that airlines are having their foods presented by celebrity chefs, perhaps that's where grade cricket is going as well. So I was just sort of thinking, you know, imagine just turning up to sort of, let's get to Melbourne. Imagine turning up to Footscray, Edgewater, and you sort of have braised chicken sliders by Heston Blumenthal. You just actually have a menu as you walk in, or deconstructed Doritos by Colin Fastenage. Do you think that's where we're going?
Yeah. Dark chocolate Tim Tams by George Calambaris.
I was going to say that Tim Tam mignonette.
I would suggest we're actually heading more towards like instant coffee and like, you know, some sort of frozen meat than we are towards celebrity chefs, if I had to guess.
Right. Well, after tonight's result with Trump, as you listen to this. Okay, let's move to the next one. I think we covered that very comprehensively.
So laughing matter.
Nordberg. The name is Nordberg.
Thank you to our Swedish listeners.
And I just say this word for word. How's best way to deal with lower grader who comes to training with new ball or one he's been shining for 6 months and bowls you?
Is there any right way? I mean, look, if someone came to me and did exactly that, look, I'd pick the ball up with my hand and I'd shout loudly, is this a two-piecer? So everyone could hear this. You know, what is this under 12s? And then I'd pick it up and I'd hit it as far as I could out of the net. You know,
just you'd literally it lob it up in the air and just belt
onto
it.
Onto the Pacific Highway, preferably.
Getting his ball and yelling out, is this a two-piecer, is basically just like going onto the sideline after you've been bowled by a bloke and just yell out really loudly as if it was in conversation. This bloke chucks it.
Exactly the same thing.
What I would do is I would get into the net early and pretend to bowl some part-time leg spin that obviously bowls into like the, you know, back, goes over the back net, that kind of thing, into the side netting. But use his ball whilst doing that, so hopefully it gets knocked around a bit, and just our friend by just picking up his ball that he's been shining since Christmas 1997.
Yeah, why you got a red king, mate? What's a red king?
Probably a little bit more realistic. I mean, the first thing that I like about the question is that like he's been bowled, but he still feels like he has to deal with it somehow. Like there needs to be some reprisal to what happens. I mean, every time I get bowled, all I want to do is smash all three stumps down with my bat. Like, you know. I say this all the time, but like, did you, no, I'm going to go too far into this, but like when I grew up with some kind of, in Christian development classes, right? Let's just say that I did religion classes and they told us that heaven was a place that you went if you were good in your life and you got to do whatever you want.
Yeah.
One of the top three things I would do in heaven, which I can't do in this life, is smash all three stumps down every time I'm bowled. Obviously, I wouldn't get bowled in heaven because all the best things are happening. But if it did happen, I would belt them all down.
Yeah, that's true.
And they just spring straight up in a sprightly manner because love is eternal.
So that's Nordberg. Luke Hema writes in, and he uses the hashtag AskTGC. He says, what does it mean when I dream that my slow pace bowling does much more off the seam than in real life? More dream questions.
I don't know how to answer that. What does it mean? I mean, obviously, nothing means anything.
Ooh,
I mean, deep. Look, I mean, it means that you're probably playing on a grassy English wicket, which is rubbish because you're probably playing on syntho with a compo ball with no seam. So what's with your dreams, mate? Take that to the psychologist.
Oh, I think there are developmental issues here. I firstly wanted to say that it was the root of optimism, just to think in your dreams, oh, no, it's going to be doing a lot more than it does in real life. But there's something developmental about not realising that it's not happening for you, you know, when your eyes are actually open and realism is happening. Yeah.
And he's a slow-paced bowler in his dream as well. So he's actually, he shouldn't be bowling.
There's always one question we have to offer.
So you know, like you know how you often have the dream of like getting run out or being timed out. One of those two. Is that because like you're dreaming of the worst case scenario in your life?
We'll have to get. I mean, we've been trying to get child psychologist Stephen Bidoff onto the show. So these are some of the questions we're going to have to tally up for him. Just a little anecdote. I was at a cricket match over the weekend. I coached some kids down in Melbourne. Shout out to the boys there. I mentioned thinking that this was just a standard thing that I constantly dream of getting timed out in my dreams. Yeah. And to a person, they all found that bizarre. None of them have had that dream. You guys dream about getting timed out, don't you?
Look, I retired about 7 years ago and I'm still having dreams about being timed out in grade cricket. I've never seen anyone get timed out in my life in any form of the game. Nah. But I imagine it happens and it's my ultimate worst nightmare.
So I get run out. I've never been timed out in my dream. I'm always run out.
Is it because you can't run in your dreams?
Yes.
Yeah.
Quicksand.
I'm always going back for the second as well.
Yeah, it's never.
I'm not getting run out on the first.
I'm not getting run out like Dave Warner did in the second innings. Like it wasn't like athletic like.
Yeah, like a really good run out. Well, I just failed to make my ground.
I'm just running a marathon third run, and I just can never get to the end of the crease ever.
And it's a direct hit from the boundary by a bloke who's just really surprising you with.
It's like a sinking feeling because you can see the ball coming. What is this?
No, it's good.
You can like see the ball coming from the boundary, and then you get that sinking feeling like I'm not going to make it. And that's when I wake up in a pool of sweat.
Yeah. Our most serious topics tonight have been dreams and afternoon tea. The next question, it comes from, there's no name, actually. There's no name attached, and there might be a reason for that. But it just says, a long-debated question, .. How many tons in a row will get you from fourth grade to the Australian team?
Okay, well, let's do this. Okay, so fourth grade to first grade, you're looking at 5 tons, I reckon. I don't think 4 is going to do it. Because, like, if there's, like, a team in, let's say...
So, he's starting in fourth grade.
He's starting in fourth grade.
So, 4s to 3s to 2s, you just need 100 to go from 4s to 2s. You're in fourth grade, you need 100. You're in third grade.
Yes.
Third grade, 100. Second grade.
Yes.
Second grade, do you need 200s?
I think you need 200s. So, there's 5. There's 500s.
Okay.
So, you need 200s in second grade, yeah?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Or if, like if your second grade team is doing really well and they're in the final spot or they might be top of the table or something, like unlikely, obviously your team's going to be 20th and looking at some sort of relegation, even though that doesn't exist in Australia.
But just to control the variables on this, he goes, because it's a very, very important question.
It is.
Are we talking about a player who hasn't sort of just arrived from interstate and just been, you know, dropped into fourth grade, but probably is of higher ability? Or are we talking about someone who is nominally of fourth grade ability, who then begins scoring hundreds?
Well,
I think that it should be that.
Context is crucial, yes.
Because if you get dropped into fourth grade and you score 100, you probably go straight into second grade. I think we've missed the situation. This guy's obviously going to be an international cricketer in 3 weeks.
But if he's been averaging between 13.5 and 18 for 7 seasons straight, and suddenly he has this majestic outlier of a season, eyebrows raised.
Eyebrows raised.
I still like that you know he's going to be an international cricketer in 3 weeks, but he only goes up to second grade from the ton.
You've got to do time.
That's because second grade are in the finals, so they need to get the win. So, so there's he needs to score 500 to get to first grade, and then you're looking at, you need like a bumper season. He's probably going to need to score 7 first grade hundreds in a row.
What, to be picked for New South Wales? Not New South Wales. How Sydney-centric is this, by the way?
To be picked in a state.
For their state.
He started 5th grade. There's no 5th grade in Melbourne.
Yeah, he needs 7 in a row. I don't think five cuts it. I think it's gonna be
seven
bumper.
First grade hundreds in a row before the state side looks at you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're probably right.
And then you get your second.
So he's 7 plus 5, 12.
12. this is almost unrealistic.
But he's got there'd be lots of media, he or she, there'd be lots of media around.
Oh,
this
once
now.
You score your seventh, yeah. Yeah.
Nothing until then.
Once you score your 12th in a row, then you know, an email from your local newspaper.
Yeah. Okay.
Scouts are coming
and then
to
you
this
get,
game.
And then you get your second 11 game for your state.
No. Sorry. It's straight into the state side, I think.
Oh, well, he's going to score. He's probably
how regimented is this?
He's going to score 10.
Okay, it's just in a row.
First grade hundreds in a row.
Yeah.
I reckon you might be able to leap a few steps if you're performing that well. I don't think you'd have to go through.
I don't know, man. It's a good player. He's not going to bat in first grade around the country.
Good point. Okay, so 10 plus 5,
yep.
15,
yep.
And you're playing for your state.
You're playing for your state.
And then how many for your state in a row with 1,500s in a row behind you?
I mean, we spoke to Ed Cowan last week, and he said it was as much about timing as anything. So you could score a lot of hundreds in a row, but a spot won't open up because the team's doing well. Obviously, in this situation, the team's doing poorly. We need runs. So we need this guy who was in fourth grade a month ago to play in the home.
Depends what your state is as well, how your state's going in the Sheffield Shield.
Very
and so
true.
Forth,
very true.
To crack that team.
So we need batsmen, so I wouldn't say there'd be too many hundreds required at that level.
Three in a row? Yeah. I reckon 18. So 18's the answer.
Okay,
18.
That's the answer, 18. That's the show. There's a lot of heads being shaken around this studio. A shout out to the people who do the music or make this happen, actually. Shano on the voiceover that you hear on the ads. Adrian, AJ, Five Stripe Studios with the music. Julia for the graphic design. And anyone else, mum, dad, who tell us that this is okay. And to everyone else, thanks for listening. This has been the Great Cricketer Episode 3. And we'll catch you next week.